This is Fresh Air. I'm Chris Spurgeon, sitting in for Terry Gross. When the album Music from Big Pink came out in 1968, it was an event in the music world. Our music historian, Ed Ward, wrote in Rolling Stone magazine, "Music from Big Pink was totally unlike anything my friends and I had ever heard, and everybody wanted to know one thing. Who are these guys, anyway?" These guys were a group called The Band.
If your memory serves you well, we're going to meet again and wait. So I'm going to unpack all my things and sit before it gets too late. No matter what, we'll come to you with another tale to tell. Did you know that we shall meet again if your memory serves you well?
The band first got together as the Hawks when they backed up an energetic rockabilly singer from Arkansas named Ronnie Hawkins. Levon Helm, the drummer, was from Turkey Scratch, Arkansas. He was the first to join. Then they moved to Canada where they found the other members of the band, Robbie Robertson, Garth Hudson, Richard Manuel, and Rick Danko. In 1964, the Hawks left Ronnie Hawkins to make it on their own. The story of how the Hawks turned into the band is told in Levon Helm's new biography, This Wheel's on Fire. In addition to the new book, Helm, along with Rick Danko and Garth Hudson, have put out a new band album called Jericho. Terry Gross recently spoke with Levon Helm. He told her that when they first went out on their own, they were getting a lot of work in clubs, but they really wanted to record.
That was our big goal, was to try and get in the studio and make records. And of course, the opportunities back in those days were a little bit on the skinny side. We met John Hammond, the blues singer. John's from New York. John would come to Toronto and come by the Concord, wherever we were playing, and jam with us, and we'd have fun like that. John put in a good word for us, and one of our first New York sessions was to record with John Hammond. We got to play with John and met Michael Bloomfield and some of the musicians that were around in those days.
John Hammond probably had something to do with Bob Dylan calling you up.
Well, I'm sure he put a good word in for us with Bob. Mary Martin, a friend of ours from Toronto, worked in Albert Grossman's office at the time, and of course, they managed Bob and Peter, Paul, and Mary, several of the artists that were popular in those days. And we didn't know, but Bob wanted a band himself. And I think Mary and John Hammond sort of helped us along with that.
So what was it like when you got the phone call, when Bob Dylan called and said he was looking for a band? This was at about the time that Like a Rolling Stone was a hit on the radio.
That's right. Rolling Stone was out, and I think that was that particular album was the first time that Bob had used a band, and it was something new, something that he wanted to do. And I didn't know a whole lot about Bob. We were more into R&B and blues music. And
well, in fact, you're right that you thought he was too folky.
Well, we weren't big folk fans. We were more we liked more instruments. We liked rhythm section. We liked horns. We liked a full house on the bandstand. And Bob was coming from more of a troubadour, you know, just him and his guitar kind of a place. And I didn't really know who he was. I hadn't connected the name with the song Like a Rolling Stone that was playing on the radio, and he called us down at Tony Mart's in Summers Point, New Jersey, and asked if we wanted to play the Hollywood Bowl with him. And I said, sure, you know, who else is going to be on the program? And he said, just us. And we asked the Colonel, our agent, if Bob could fill up the Hollywood Bowl, and the Colonel said that he thought he could. And we had a couple of rehearsals, and we ended up playing Forest Hills with Bob. A couple of us, Robbie and myself, came out of our group, and he had Harvey Brooks and Al Cooper that he had played with, up at Newport.
You know, when he played at Newport, he was booed by, at the Newport Folk Festival, he was booed by the crowd there because he had just gone electric, which was very controversial. So,
yeah. Well, he was booed when we went electric with him at Forest Hills,
right.
too.
Well, did he give you advice on what to do if you got booed?
He told us, we had a little huddle there backstage before we went on for the second half. He played the first half by himself, and it went just smooth as silk, and the crowd loved it. And the second half, we huddled, and we knew. We had read and heard about, things getting a little bit tough in Newport. He told us, whatever happens, don't stop playing. Just keep playing and give it a chance to settle down. And we did, and I don't know if it ever settled or not.
You left the band shortly after it became Dylan's backup band. Why did you leave it? I mean, this was like, in retrospect, a great opportunity for the group.
Well, it was, and I probably could have been smarter about it, but we had played most of the American part of the tour. Bob wanted to play Europe. He wanted to go to Australia, and so we played through the Northeast, which was pretty tough. Towns like Boston, they gave us a standing ovation of boos, and at the same time, we would hit Fort Worth, Texas, and it would be just another good rock and roll party. But it started wearing on me. And I got to the point where I couldn't find enough funny things to laugh about it. I didn't feel like joking around all the time like I usually do. And rather than really make a boner, I decided that maybe I should let the tour go ahead to Europe and to Australia and some foreign places without running the risk of making a monkey out of myself. So I stayed back and waited on everybody. I went back to Arkansas and played with the Cate Brothers Band and kind of picked up where I'd left off playing dances and so forth.
So you rejoined the band after the band moved to the Catskills, which was after Bob Dylan's motorcycle accident.
Yes, ma'am. He had a bike, spilled his bike after they got back, so it kind of changed directions, and instead of so much touring, there was a lot of extra time, to put music together. And Garth set up his Ampex tape machine in the basement there at Big Pink, and we started getting together and just putting songs together, and trying our voices, finding out, how to stack our harmonies and just things like that that helped us out later on.
Well, you write in your book that you think the song Ain't No More Cain, which is actually recorded on the basement tapes, was a real breakthrough for the group. What did you think was a breakthrough about it?
Probably the voices. That's when we first started swapping the lead vocals around, we would trade verses, and we found out a couple of different ways to stack the harmonies and the answers up with the lead vocals. So that helped us a lot as far as finding out, the different possibilities for our voices.
Well, let's hear Ain't No More Cain from the basement tapes.
All right.
Ain't no more. Should have been on the river.
That's the band, and my guest is Levon Helm, who's co-authored a new book called This Wheel's on Fire, Levon Helm and the Story of the Band. The band also has a new record called Jericho. So when you moved to the Catskills, and the band was living in a house that was pink and was nicknamed Big Pink, did you move into the house with them?
Yes, I did. Moved into the house there. There was an extra spot for me, and we used it as our headquarters and music room for a couple of 3 years there.
What was it like to all live together and play together? It could get very insular. You could really get on each other's nerves in a situation like that.
Well, not for us. We had been doing this for years. We had traveled and shared the same bedroom and bed on different occasions. There had certainly been times when maybe we could afford two rooms, and after a few flips of the old coin, we found out who was going to get the couch and who might get an extra pillow and take the floor. So, no, we got along good, and things were a lot of fun for us. We had never had that kind of time on our hands. We had come from the school of playing six nights a week and a dance on Sundays if we could manage it. And, of course, Ronnie Hawkins could usually manage to book that extra night. So all of a sudden, there we are in the Catskills, and we don't have a show to play that night. So we were enjoying it, just sitting around and, the freedom to go down and play some music or go outside and throw a football around at each other.
So after recording in the basement, you finally got to record an album. The album was The Big Pink, your first album, but the band's name was not initially supposed to be The Band. What was it supposed to be, and how did you end up with the name The Band?
We didn't know what it was supposed to be, and we had signed an agreement with Capitol Records. It hadn't come to that yet. We were trying to sign an agreement, and we ended up signing the agreement as The Crackers, and we thought that was funny. Nobody else did, especially the record company.
Was the joke that everybody except you was from the North?
Well, that, we tried the Honkies just for variety, and they didn't think that was too funny either. But people referred to us as the band. You know, Bob's at the hotel, and the band is headed for the sound check. So on the Big Pink record, when it came time for the credits to list everybody's names, I think it said something like The Band, and then underneath it, it told you who all was in the band. So when we cut our second record, the record company kind of shifted that back around, and they liked that better than The Crackers.
It's funny, here was this band that had been on the road together for so long, right? And now that you had gotten used to recording in the basement and had an album out, you didn't really want to go on the road.
Well, by the time we got our record recorded, we had learned a whole lot more than we had ever known before about the way we sounded and the different combinations we could use by changing instruments around. So we didn't want to go on the road. We wanted to continue to record and try and refine some of our formulas, to help us do better music, and we thought the closer we stuck with it, now that we had learned the fundamentals of playing music in a recording studio, we didn't want to go back to playing live and forget what we had learned. We wanted to kind of keep honing that particular style of chops. It's different playing in a studio than it is playing live, of course. So we had managed to develop some studio chops, and we didn't want to back away from it that quick.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Levon Helm. He's written a new book about the band called This Wheel's on Fire. The band also has a new album called Jericho. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Levon Helm is my guest. When did things start going bad for the band, within the band? Dissension and things like that. I mean, for example, you write in the book about how really annoyed you were when you'd see on records that Robbie Robertson had all the songwriting or most of the songwriting credits.
Well, that was a bit of a distraction. I didn't think it was quite fair. Not that Robbie didn't do a lot of the songwriting, most of it in some spots, but at the same time, Richard did some good work, and I always thought that that Garth and Rick and myself was there all the way, no matter whose idea the song was or if it was halfway there or, you know, it was finished. Most of our stuff then got finished under that workshop kind of circumstance, and that was just one of the things that came up that kind of created a little bit of tension in the group. I could see it, you know, hampering our collaboration, and started bothering the spirit of it.
Robbie Robertson, in I guess it was 76, decided he wanted to leave the band, and the band should break up and have this big finale concert and go out with a real bang. You didn't want the band to break up, so you tried to resist that, but I guess you weren't able to.
Well, I wasn't. By then, maybe the last waltz started back, you know, during some of the disenchantment that I felt when the songs didn't reflect what I thought was the true spirit of things. So by the time the last waltz came up, it was no secret our collaboration and I thought that the quality of our music had suffered. I didn't hear us getting better. I heard us doing albums with old songs that we liked as opposed to getting in and really trying to grow a fresh crop of songs. And I certainly didn't want to end the band. The last waltz, didn't set right with me. But, you know, there comes a time when we all want to move on, and that's what we did.
Martin Scorsese directed the film The Last Waltz, the film of the last concert performance in which there were lots and lots of guest stars. Did you like the film?
I liked some parts of it. Overall, I didn't like it a whole lot because I felt that some of the best songs and some of the best moments were still on the cutting room floor.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you ever reconciled with Robbie Robertson?
Well, at this point, there's not a lot of reconciliation that has to be done. That was the way I felt at the time, and it's this much later now, and we're doing good, and Robbie's doing good with his solo career, so it probably all worked out for the best.
Hmm. Now, the band reunited in 83, but just a few years after that, Richard Manuel hung himself. Were you shocked by that? Did you see it coming at all?
You know, it's hard to see trouble coming. At the time, I thought we were doing pretty well. We didn't have a recording contract, and there didn't seem to be one available for us. And what kept us going was when we played for the people. When we played music, everybody liked it, and we never had anybody ask for their money back. And I thought we were still sounding good, and we were evolving. It was painful. But I didn't think it was as painful as that, and I certainly didn't see it coming.
So, do you think that his suicide had to do with his disappointment in what had happened with the band in terms of not having a recording contract and not playing big venues in the way that the band used to, or was it much more personal than that?
If I had to hazard a guess, I would say that it was more personal, and I would also admit that where the band was at and how quick it looked like we were going to get to where we wanted to go, it didn't look as rosy as it could have. So, whatever personal problems that anybody was having. You know, the situation with the band could be some discomfort at that time. None of us were satisfied with where we were at, and we weren't satisfied with how quick we were getting it changed.
Did you think about him a lot when putting together the new record?
Yes, we did, because we had Country Boy, which was the last song that Richard recorded with the band, and it was a great tune, a great performance on Richard's part, and we were never able to get it finished and to finish the other songs that needed to go with it to make up a whole album. So it didn't get to come out when we thought it would, and when we finally managed to put the rest of the songs for Jericho together, I don't think it occurred to any of us not to use Richard's song.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we close with something from the band's new album, Jericho? Is there something on here you'd particularly like to hear that you're particularly happy with?
Well, the song that they're playing up in Canada, and they tell me that it's a radio hit, which is unusual for the band. I think maybe Cripple Creek got up to number 15 or 20 in the old days, and the first tune on the record, Remedy, it's called, has got some good horn parts in there. Garth plays some good organ, and we're having a hell of a time.
Well, let's hear it, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Levon Helm has a new book called This Wheel's on Fire, Levon Helm and the Story of the Band, and the band has a new album called Jericho. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.